ॐ नमो ब्रह्मादिभ्यो ब्रह्मवंशाय शत्रुभ्यो वंशर्षिभ्यो नमो गुरुभ्यः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Salutations to Brahman and the gods. Salutations to the teachers of the knowledge of Brahman. Salutations to all the sages and saints of our lineage. Salutations, Om, peace, peace, peace. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhetamastu, Ma Vindishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us. Well, we're continuing our series on sages of the Upanishads. This is the 10th in our series. And it's going to go on a while. Today's sages are taken up from the Upanishad called the Brihadaranyaka, which is the most famous probably of all the Upanishads. And it is widely quoted and very voluminous, so it provides us many sages to discuss. We're in the third chapter today, third overall chapter, section one. And it's about Janaka and Yajnavalkya. I have put that very complicated name on the board so that you can learn to say it if you want to. Yajnavalkya. Of course, there's no hyphen in it in Sanskrit. That's just for you. But Yajnavalkya is the principal sage of the Upanishads, I would say. If there's any one sage we have to pick out as being the primary one, it will have to be Yajnavalkya. Janaka is the king. He's called King Janaka of Videha. Now, in those days, you understand what a king meant. A king meant the ruler of a tribe, a province. What we would now call a province of India would be Videha, probably even smaller than the province. And the ruler of that little area was euphemistically called a king. So, King Janaka is performing a very elaborate sacrifice. And you remember that when Nachiketa complained to his father about the hypocrisy of the sacrifices made on his part to get him up to heaven. So that we know what it is. I don't have to say more, I think, about the society. It was a fire-sacrificing society. And this king is making a big sacrifice. And he, in order to do that, he summons a great number of Brahmins to come. And the Brahmins all come from different areas, not just Videha, but all around. And he has offerings and gifts to give them. And the gifts that he has to give them are, in this case, cows. And if you want to know why the cow is sacred in India, well, we'll take that up another day. But the cow was sacred, of course, because it was the commercial item. It was the coinage. You owned cows, you paid in cows, you borrowed in cows, and so on and so forth. So they're all gathered together there, and the priests around there, Brahmins were priests, so I might say Brahmins, I mean priests. In this King Janaka, there arose a desire to know which of these Brahmins was the most learned. Contests. So there was a contest. Which one of you is the most learned? And so he enclosed 1,000 cows in a pen. In a pen. 1,000 cows. I mean, pretty big pen. And on the horns of each cow, he hung 10 gold coins, 5 on each horn. Cows had horns. So he put 5 coins, gold coins, on the horns of each one. And he said, all right, now all these cows go to the one sage who succeeds in proving himself to be the most learned of the Brahmins. That's the story. Janaka is supposed to be the father of Sita. You know the Ramayana, Sita, Rama, and Sita, and Ramayana. So Sita is called Janaki, the daughter of Janaka. And Janaka was the king. I don't know how you can work out the chronology of this, but presumably the Ramayana is as old as this is, because otherwise how would he be her father? So anyway, and he is a prominent king. He's himself a champion philosopher, and he is the champion of the Kshatriya class, the caste. See, he's a Kshatriya, being a king, second caste. And so among them, he ranks very high. He's a champion. And that's about all that we really know about Janaka. I'm sorry to say I can't tell you more, except you'll find out more by the questions and answers that come up in the discussion. Now, he was so learned that eventually he was made what is called a Rajarshi. Raja and Rishi are put together. So that means he was a Rajarshi, a royal sage. A sage who is also a king. But the more important figure here is Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya is the author of a code which is as important as the Manu code. Most of you from India know of the code of Manu. Now the code of Manu is so famous that it is included in all the research books and the books of comparative religion and so on. Everybody talks about the Manu code, but actually the code of Yajnavalkya was more important than the Manu code. It was more applied. The Manu code, there are lots of lapses of the Manu code, but the Yajnavalkya code, as found in the Shatapatha Brahmana, has been much more adhered to and more influential, generally. So that's his main claim to fame, that he was the author of this code, great and long-standing set of principles for living. You know, like Confucius gave so many details about how the society should function. So this Yajnavalkya is the kind of Confucius of the Indian society of that time. Well, He was a contemplative, and he was the priest advisor of Janaka. So Janaka has got his own favorite priest there, and yet he has opened the contest to all of the Brahmins. And so, if you want to find more out about Yajnavalkya, you can look in the Shukla Yajurveda, because that is the particular Veda in which he is specialist. Well, you know what happens? Yajnavalkya comes out and he says to his disciple, "Boy, open the pen and lead these cows to our place." That's what he says. That's what it says here. He said to his pupil, with a long name, "My dear, drive these cows, drive them away, drive them to our place." The Brahmins were enraged. How can he dare to declare himself to be the wisest Brahmin among us? Now, the next, a competitor arises. Now there was Ashwala, another priest of Janaka. And he said, "Yajnavalkya, are you indeed the wisest Brahmin amongst us?" He replied, "I bow to the wisest Brahmin amongst us. I just want those cows." That's what it says. It says that right here in the book. "I bow to the wisest Brahmin, but I just want to have these cows." So, so Ashwala, another priest, decides to question him. And this is the kind of discussion, that's what we call it, convention, convocation, discussion. This is what they were doing among the learned people of 2,000, 3,000 years B.C. Just imagine it. And we think we're evolved. We call ourselves evolved. And man's brain is supposed to be enlarged and everything is supposed to be. Here these people are discussing the highest metaphysical principles, the most learned topics, so long ago. And we are trying to understand them with our brains. I just want to point that out in passing. So, anyway, he answers the technical questions first. I'm going to read one of the passages that shows you the kind of technical question that Ashwala was asking him. He asks him, for five verses, he asks him technical questions about what do you do in the sacrifice, in this complicated social ritual that goes on day after day to placate the gods and get yourself a good place in heaven, and so on and so forth, and win you some better property or better herds of cows, whatever. This goes on, and so he's asking, what do you know about all these details? How good a priest are you? The first five questions are, how good a priest are you? And he answers very appropriately. The sixth one says, Yajnavalkya, the challenging priest, says, since the sky is, as it were, without a support, by what means of ascent does a sacrificer reach the heavenly world? How do you get up there? You're trying to get to heaven, but how do you get up there? There's no ladder. And he answers, by the Brahma priest, by the mind, by the moon. Verily, mind is the Brahma of the sacrifice. That which is this mind is the yonder moon. This is the Brahman. This is freedom. This is complete freedom. This is concerning freedom. Very difficult to interpret. It's a challenge. I remember studying with a Buddhist nun years and years ago who told us that one of the experiences that you have in mystical, in the attainment of nirvana, was to see the mind moon. The mind moon. Now, this is not Hinduism, this is Buddhism, this is the Theravada. And it's talking about the mind moon. If you go into the mythology of the cultures of the world, you'll find that it's very often there's a link, some kind of link between the mind and the moon. Not only between the mind and the month, mind and the menses, mind and the moon. I mean, moon and the menses, moon and the month, but moon and the mind. I'm not going to go into that, take time to go into that now, but just notice that this is one of the earliest sources for the idea of the mind and the moon being connected. And you can see by this verse that Yajnavalkya is no fool. He's taking up all of this liturgical and ritualistic knowledge, and he's trying to wean them away into something which is more subtle, which is to indicate that matter, getting up to heaven is more a matter of the mind than it is of ladders. Okay? Now, next he goes into deeper questions. And we have another priest comes up, and his name is Artabhaga. Artabhaga questioned him. And then he asked a little more deep question, and I have to explain this one. The first one is, how many perceivers are there, and how many beyond the perceivers? I'll explain this. How many perceivers are there, and how many are there beyond the perceivers? And Yajnavalkya answers 8. And the next verses tell you what are those 8. And I'll just give you a rundown. The nose is a perceiver, and smells are the what's beyond the perception, perceiver. The tongue is a perceiver, and flavors are what's beyond the perceiver. And so on. With the ear, the mind, the hands are the organ of perception, and actions which they perform are what's beyond the perceiver. So now we come to the important one for us. And all of these are subject to death, says Yajnavalkya. All of these are passing things. They're temporary. They're going to die. They're going to pass away. I'm going to read 13. Artabhaga says, Yajnavalkya, when the speech, when the voice of this dead person enters into fire, because cremation, everybody's cremated. When this voice of the dead person enters into fire, the breath into air, the eye into the sun, the mind into the moon, hearing into the quarters, the self into the space, the hairs of the body into the herbs, the hairs on the head into the trees, and the blood and the semen are deposited in water, what becomes of this person? Now there's a question for you. Can you get behind the question? Can you understand what's going on here? Is it just folklore? Is it pseudoscience, as our wiseacres today would probably label it? What is behind it? I'm going to finish the verse, but I want you to understand what's in Yajnavalkya, what's in Artabhaga's mind. Death, somatic death, is a what's the word I want? Somatic death is a symbol, that's not strong enough, caricature, a cartoon of the death of the ego. When the ego dies, our center of attachment, our center of concentration and identity moves from the microcosm to the macrocosm. So, though it looks like folklore analogies between the grass and the beard or the hairs and the trees, and what else, with mine and the moon and so on. You see, he's trying to lift their thought far away from this body and the individual, limited individual, and to make it more cosmic. He has a cosmic sense of identity. He's trying to give that, convey that to the company of Brahmins, that there is a cosmic identity to all these things. That's what's behind it. You don't notice that, but that's what's behind it. So let me go on and finish the verse. Very interesting. Artabhaga, my dear. Oh, yes, he says, what becomes of this person when the blood and semen go to water and the eye goes to the sun? What's the eye of this universe, or this world? The sun. The sun is the eye of this world. And so on. That's what's implied there. And Yajnavalkya says, Artabhaga, my dear, take my hand. We two alone shall know about this. This is not for us to speak of in public. The two went away and deliberated. And what they said was karma. And what they praised was karma. Verily, one becomes good by good action, bad by bad action, and therefore Artabhaga kept silent. What's happened here? Yajnavalkya has discovered that this priest is worthy to be a disciple. He's worth working on individually instead of in the group. So he takes him aside, and they go into a secluded place. And there he imparts to him the highest truth. And the interesting part about it is, this may not be the very highest truth, but it's higher truth than Artabhaga had before. And so it constitutes an opening. It constitutes an aha, a satori, whatever you want to call it. And for Artabhaga. Now, the interesting thing also is, what did they praise? What did they find? What did they discover? Karma. And the Radhakrishnan, who wrote this book, calls our attention to the fact that in Buddhism, the same thing occurs. You have no individual soul. You have no in universal entity into which the soul dissolves or into which the soul is merged, which is what you would expect from the Upanishad. You have only a bundle of karmas. What keeps the cycle of samsara going is this bundle of karmas, which remains after death. When the individual, supposed individual, has disappeared. And you know, Buddhism's doctrine is that even now, in this, while living, we have no real individuality. And it's not a question of the individual being absorbed in the universal. It's a question of the bundle of karmas, which is the result of past actions, being passed down from generation to generation. Now, Vedanta doesn't accept that explanation because it doesn't think it's logical. But here is an example of where the two have met, Buddhism and Hinduism, because karma is the answer that both of them are satisfied to accept. See, what is it that remains when this person has died? His karma remains. Whether he belongs to a soul which can own it, or whether that bundle of karma operates, as the Buddhists say, independently on its own, producing another body and so on and so forth. It doesn't really matter. The result is the same. It's karma. Karma is what's left when you die. If you are not illumined, if you haven't had mukti, if you haven't had the freedom experience, well, karma remains and will produce another life for you over and over again.
Samadhi, when the mind dies, the thought does not remain.
Pardon?
When the mind dies, the thought does not remain.
Thought does not remain.
Remain means, you know, just in the way there is survival of karma after the death of different elements. One of the elements is mind.
Yeah.
So when the mind dies, the thought that it processed,
yes,
do they remain or do they go away?
No, but the mind doesn't die. You see, that's the trouble. Our mind doesn't die if we have illumination.
Put them in that category, didn't they? You said one was mind.
Mind had gone to the moon. Well, that's just a resting place. Mind has gone to the moon, that's a parking lot. Moon is a parking lot for the mind in between death, in between incarnations. All right, now, then, where do we go next? All right, we go to four. Fourth Brahmana. Now comes another sage to test Yajnavalkya. His name is Chakrayana. Do I read this? Let's see. Yes. All right, one and two. Then Chakrayana asked him, Yajnavalkya, explain to me the Brahman that is immediately present and directly perceived, who is the Self in all things. These people were not fooled. Here is the challenging priest asking him about Vedanta's highest conclusion. There is a thing called Brahman, and it is present immediately and directly perceived, present everywhere, and who is the Self of everything, the essence. All things. This is yourself. Oh, this is the answer. Yajnavalkya says, this is yourself that is within all things. Which is within all things, Yajnavalkya? And my opinion, I have no basis, no proof of this, my opinion is that he is either pointing at him or touching him. This is what the teachers do in confrontation like this. When you want to answer a question like that, the teacher either points to you or touches you and says, this is the Self. This is the Self. And then, of course, in another Upanishad, it has to be stripped of body, senses, mind, and all of the upadhis have to be taken off, and you find out what is the real capital Self. But here, he just says, this is yourself, it is within all things, and Chakrayana says, which one? Which part of me? And Yajnavalkya replies, he who breathes in your breathing, he who breathes in with your breathing in is the Self of yours, which is in all things. He who breathes out with your breathing out is the Self of yours, which is in all things. He who breathes about with your breathing about is the Self of yours, which is in all things. He who breathes up with your breathing up is the Self of yours, which is in all things. And he is yourself which is in all things. And those of you who come to the Thursday class, you will understand what the matter with this is. What's the matter with this verse? It's the translation. Doesn't mean breathing at all. It means the prana. We know the word used in the Sanskrit is prana. And to mistakenly translate it in English as breath is a serious, serious blunder. You can't make any sense out of this verse if you translate prana as breath. Let me translate it, let me do it for you in Sanskrit, so to speak. He who represents the incoming energies in you is that self of yours which is in all things. The one who expresses energy outward from you is that energy which is in all things. That energy in you which circulates around and about and inside you is that same universal energy, and that particular form of energy which makes things come up in you is the same, things which go down, same, all of that is that self of yours which is in all things. It is yourself which is in all things. Another Upanishad has prana as the chief entity. In other words, instead of Brahman, in that Upanishad, the word prana is used in place of Brahman. Prana. What is it? Life energy. What we call energy in our Western science is only the crust, the external, gross manifestation of this thing that we call prana in Vedanta. Prana is subtle material, subtle energy. It's that subtle realm, the quantum people are trying to make out, which is both time and space, which is both matter and energy, because there's no real distinction. In this gross world of ours, our waking state and the gross world, that prana takes the form of what we call kinetic and so on, radiational, other kinds of energies. But behind that is a subtler energy to which Yajnavalkya is referring, and that is the energy which makes the subtle body operate. I don't know, medical people here, forgive me, but this is what it is. This is what it says. Anyway, Chakrayana comes back at him. Chakrayana doesn't like this answer. So we're going to see what he says. You have explained this as one might say, this is a cow, this is a horse. Explain to me the Brahman that is immediately present and directly perceived, that is the self in all things. Yajnavalkya doesn't like the answer. Why doesn't he like the answer? Anybody? Can you say why he doesn't like the answer? Why did he say, you have explained this as if you had said, this is a horse, this is a cow? Object. Yes. Or what we might just also say, what else might we say? Might say, too limited. Too limited? Too literal? Yes.
Literal.
Too literal. Too literal. Too limited. In other words, Chakrayana, no fool either. He suspects that there's a deeper truth behind this answer than Yajnavalkya has given. And so he says, you know, you've put names on it. You've put, yes, you've made it objective. You've put names on it. Now, tell me what it really is in truth. And Yajnavalkya obligingly, he's got to get those cows. obligingly, they say, answers in detail. You cannot see the seer of seeing. You cannot hear the hearer of hearing. You cannot think the thinker of thinking. You cannot understand the understander of understanding. He is yourself, Atman, which is in all things. Everything else is of evil. Everything else is rotten. Nothing else is important. That's what that means. Everything else is worthless. After that, Chakravyana kept quiet. So, he has conquered two or three sages already, getting well along towards those cows.
What is the Sanskrit word he uses for evil?
What is it?
What is the Sanskrit word he uses for evil here? Because it might be a bad translation.
Yeah, well, it's... let me see what that is. Oh, sarvandha ato anyad artham, not artha, other than artha, not true.
Yeah.
Why should it be? Why should he translate it as evil? You're right. Good. I'm glad you caught that.
That's why I objected. There is no word in
anartha.
Exactly.
Anartha means not right.
Not right. Yeah.
Meaningful.
Meaningful.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. But we've solved the problem of evil already today. let's go to five. Fifth Brahmana. Fifth section of chapter 3. This sage is, his name is Kaushitakeya. And Kaushitakeya asks him to explain something, and the verse which he gives in reply is one of the most famous and most quoted verses I have heard, because it is the monk's verse, the renunciate's verse. Favorite quotation, scriptural support for monastic life. You'll see. And please don't take offense. Which is that which is within all things, Yajnavalkya? It is that which transcends hunger and thirst, sorrow and delusion, old age and death. Brahmanas, having known that self with a capital S, having overcome the desire for sons, the desire for wealth, the desire for worlds, live the life of mendicants. That which is the desire for sons, let's say children, is the desire for wealth. That which is the desire for wealth is the desire for worlds. And all of these are but desires. Therefore, let a Brahmana, after he has done with learning, that's the Brahmacharya stage, after he's done with learning, desire to live as a child. Now, I'm going to comment on that, but let me go on and finish the verse. I'll come back to that. Desire to live as a child. When he becomes silent meditator, when he has done with both the state of childhood and with learning, then he becomes a silent meditator. Having done with both the non-meditative and the meditative states, then he becomes a Brahmana, a knower of Brahman. How does the Brahmana behave? Asks Kaushitakeya. And Yajnavalkya has a nice answer. Howsoever he may behave, he is indeed a Brahmana. Everything else is anrita, anartha, anartha.
What does he mean by that?
Yeah, I'm coming to that. And Kaushitikeya kept silent. So this verse is the basis or scriptural authority for taking up the monastic life. And he gives the stages of it, you see. But it didn't remain like this. It got changed into the Chatur Ashrama, the system of four stages of life, which was much more suitable to the preservation of society. If all of the Brahmins became monks, there wouldn't be any more Brahmins. So I'm sure the four stages was a later development to protect the society from teachings like this. But anyway, the teaching here is this, that he gives up all these desires for wealth and worlds and children and learning and so on, but he has to do learning in order to get anywhere. So after he has had his studentship, he should desire to live as a child. Now, Dr. Radhakrishnan, I think, has given a correct commentary on this. I like what he says, and I think this is the answer to it. It is not a question of remaining a child, but of becoming a child. As in the Bible and the New Testament, except you become as a child, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. So here, too, he, though learned in all of the lore that has been given him, he pushes it away and becomes a child. It involves the sacrifice of intellectual conceit. We must be able to acquire naivete. It's what Lao Tzu calls returning to the root. St. Paul says, "Thou art beside thyself. Much learning has made thee mad." St. Francis once said that a great scholar, when he joined the order, ought in some sort to resign even his learning in order that he might be truly resigned to God. So that's what apparently this means, that he should become like a child in that his absence of attachment and ego. And then, when he has gone through both the studentship and this childhood state, and he's finished with learning, he's all finished with intellectual pursuits, then what? He becomes a silent meditator. A muni. Muni, silent meditator. Here comes a muni. Mauna. Having done with both, then there's a further stage. This is the whole series, right here in this verse, is the whole laid out series of the stages of monastic life. It's wonderful. It really is a wonderful verse for us. Anyway, we feel that way. Because he says, having gone beyond both the non-meditative and the meditative states, he becomes what we call a Paramahamsa. That's not in this verse, but we would call that a Paramahamsa. He becomes a Brahmana, a knower of Brahman, a perfected, a matured, a completed example of Brahmin. Then how does such... Now, this is the part that Uma wanted to know about. How does such a Brahmin behave? How does such a Brahmana behave? And instead of giving what you find in the last verses of the second chapter of the Gita, how does a stita pragyan, Hey, man of steady wisdom does this, he behaves like this. Sri Krishna answers that question in the Gita with many details. How he behaves. He sits this way, he talks this way, he's full of these virtues and those virtues and has none of these vices. This is a higher experience. This is a bigger answer. This is a larger picture than that.
What I want to understand, why does he say howsoever he behaves?
Yeah, I'm coming. Wait, give me a chance.
It's there. The explanation is there. Yeah, wait.
I'm talking and you won't wait till I come to the end of the sentence. Give me a chance. So he gives a larger answer. He gives the answer which you find in the scriptures, the highest of the Advaitic scriptures, and in stories about monks who are Paramahamsas. You know the case of Durvasas very well. You know the case of Durvasas. Worldly wisdom and monastic discipline will criticize a person of this state and say that he has gone beyond the pale of the social conventions and monastic conventions, and he is acting in a wayward way or self-willed way. But if you read enough of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and I hope you have and do, you will see many instances in which, in one place, somebody accosts him, somebody criticizes him, accosts him, and says, "Why do you do this?" Well, he violated some petty rule of conventional behavior, and somebody called him on it. And he said, "I will dance naked before 100 girls." You understand? Freedom. I have to have, and I have to claim, total freedom. I am not any longer bound by your conventions, by your social rules. I don't have to behave according to the way people are supposed to behave in the society, because I've gone beyond the society. I'm not going to make any case for it. I'm just going to tell you, this is the finality of it. This is the ultimate state. You do howsoever you do, you do. And that's right. Now we're coming to the end here. This particular man, Kaushitakeya, asks too many questions. And Yajnavalkya is becoming impatient. And he says, it's not this man, it's the next sage. The next sage, and last one, I hope, I guess, is a woman. This is Gargi. You've all been hearing about Gargi. Gargi was the author, Marie-Louise Burke, was given the monastic name, Gargi. She took sannyasa from our president of our order and became a sannyasini, and was given the name in Gargi in honor of this sage. And of course I could go on a long time talking about the gender factor, that this woman comes up in the midst of the assembly and nobody comments on the fact that she's of the other gender. We believe firmly that in those days the patriarchal obsession had not arisen, and that the women were perfectly equal so far as being able to debate in the assembly. You remember Maitreyi, who asked her husband the right questions, and she's famous for having asked those questions.
Even Shankaracharya was
yes, by the wife of
Manan Mishra's wife.
Right. She's another one. Yeah. But anyway, Gargi is the one we've got to deal with right now. Gargi said, "What is all this here woven on, like warp and woof? You like that? Well, she asks so many questions that he finally says, enough. I'll read this passage because we have a little time. And Gargi Rakshasavi asked him, Yajnavalkya, she, since all this here is woven like warp and woof in water, she has a scientific approach which understands how important water is to everything in the universe. Life, everything, water is a component. She knows it. She knows it intuitively. All right, so what prey is water woven on? She's going to get to the bottom of this element. It's the last thing she does. What is water woven on like warp and woof? On Vayu. And I'm going to use the Sanskrit words because in the Thursday class, you know, we discovered that these translation words in English are not adequate for the elements that they were talking about. So she says, Ap. What are these all? What is Ap woven on? On Vayu, O Gargi. Ah, and what is Vayu woven on like warp and woof? On Akasha, O Gargi. And what, pray, are the worlds of what are the worlds of Akasha woven on like warp and woof? And then he goes on and gives her a bunch of malarkey. He gives her answers that are not in the philosophy about Gandharvas and the moon, the worlds of the moon, and heavenly worlds and stars and so on, the worlds of the stars, the upper worlds, the heavens and so on. And he's pulling the wool over her eyes. Now, I suspect that he's treating her differently from the men. But you may not like that. You may think that she's not being treated any differently from the men. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, he goes on like this. Then what are they woven on? What is this woven on? She keeps right on asking the same question. What is Prajapati? And then on the worlds of Brahma. On what then are the worlds of Brahma woven like warp and woof? And Yajnavalkya said, Gargi, do not ask too many questions or your head will fall off. That's what it said. Don't ask too many questions or your head will fall off. This has been said in many of the Upanishadic passages. Not many. It's been said in some. That was a tradition that carried right on down the centuries. That if you couldn't answer the question, if you were really stymied by the debate, the loser's head would fall off. I hope it was just humorous and not literal. Anyway,
it's the limitedness of a man's head.
Huh?
This is the limitedness of a man's head, I say.
Oh, okay. So, I'm going to finish. I want to finish what I've got here. Bear with me. He said, "You ask too many questions; your head will fall off." Verily, you are questioning too much about a divinity about which we are not to ask too much. Now he's become very lofty and pompous. We're not supposed to ask much about Brahman. You're asking about Brahman and we're not supposed to ask about Brahman. Well, she kept quiet anyway. She kept quiet, but she had a lot of questions. Now, the last section. I haven't got the finest. I haven't got the faintest idea. Perhaps he saw in her a deep conviction of the reality of those higher worlds. She may have been one who performed sacrifice to get a high place in heaven. In one of those heavens. he might have seen that and therefore elaborated the falsity of all those heavens. They had something beneath them, beneath them, beneath them. That's a guess. I don't really know. But anyway, the last Brahmana is the seventh one. I'm just going to go through it quickly. What it does is this. It says it's important because this is the doctrine of the inner controller. The Antaryami in Sanskrit is called the inner controller. And with this, more of us can relate than with the earlier parts that I've given today. One sage after another, or is it one sage? No, it's just one sage, Gautama. Gautama asks all these questions. What is it that holds everything together? What holds this world together as like a thread? When a person who dies, his limbs are loosened, for they are held together by Vayu as by a thread, and so on. He goes on. He who dwells, this is the way all the verses go, so I'll just give you a few samples. He who dwells in water, yet is within the water, whom the water does not know, whose body the water is, who controls the water from within, he is your Atman, the inner controller, the immortal. In all these verses, he takes up the sky, the air, the heavens, and he takes up the quarters of space, the moon, the stars, and he takes up darkness, light. He takes up, finally, he says, he who dwells in all beings, and yet is within all beings, whom the beings do not know, and whose body the beings are, bodies the beings are, who controls all beings from within, he is yourself, the inner controller, the immortal, and thus far with respect to beings. And he goes on with the microcosm, the eye, the speech, the skin, the mind, all of that. And then I will read the last verse. This is an extremely important doctrine. It's the doctrine which points to that within us, which it is impossible to analyze, which it is impossible to discover by anatomy or by dissection or by microscopes or any other known procedure, any other external procedure. That which inside us we do not know, but of which we are the bodies and which controls us from within is called the inner controller, the Antaryami. And here is the last verse in that series. He who dwells in the semen and is other than the semen, whom the semen does not know, whose body the semen is, who controls the semen from within, that is yourself, the inner controller, the immortal. He is never seen, but is the seer. He is never heard, but is the hearer. He is never perceived, but is the perceiver. Never thought, but is the thinker. There is no other seer but he, there is no other hearer than he, there is no other perceiver but he, no other thinker but he. He is your Atman, the inner controller, the immortal. Everything else is false and Uddalaka Aruni kept quiet. So I'll keep quiet now. Have any questions or comments?
In Balkia's answer to Gargi, when he said, or your head will fall off, just a thought that struck me that if she's asking questions that keep penetrating further and further and further, this idea of your head will fall off could Right. Could that be as the same as saying you'll go out of your mind, which is precisely where you want to go?
Good for you. Good for you. That's a very, very, very Vyagyavalkya type of answer. Yes. You'll get the cows, I think, today.
Is that why Buddha was silent?
Right. Well, exactly.
Is that why Buddha was
exactly.
Silent?
Exactly. Yeah. That, in my opinion, that's why Buddha was silent. Yes.
He was far wiser.
Yajnavalkya is saying, really saying the same thing. He's saying, about this deity, you need not ask any more questions.
No, yeah.
You cannot rationalize.
Right. Following up on your question, when Swami Vivekananda was given the experience of Nirvikalpa Samadhi by Sri Ramakrishna, and he was lying there on the floor, and a brother disciple found him and thought he was ill. And Swamiji said, "Where is my body? Where is my body? All I can feel is my head." So when you get to the best question, the last question, even your head will fall off. Even you'll lose consciousness. You'll lose consciousness even of your head, and you will be in Nirvikalpa Samadhi.
Mm-hmm. And basically he thought that he died, his head fell off. But for the fraction of a moment he felt that his head fell off. But when he looked, when his consciousness was awakened, he saw that he was a body. The whole universe was his body and everything, you know. And you
right.
Know, it's a silver...
Somatic body dissolved in the universal body.
That's it.
This is Swami Ramdas?
No. I don't remember.
Okay.
But something related to that, yeah.
All right.
So much interested in material gain.
Yes, for me.
He had to live.
He's still alive.
Can I answer that question?
Yes.
There is a story about Yajnavalkya that even when he was a student, the rule was that every day the student has to take one lotus to the king. And when Yajnavalkya's turn came, he saw that the king was drunken. He was behaving in a very, very embarrassing way. So he refused to give that lotus and came back like that. So the king was very insulted. And then he thought it over and he says, "It's my fault." So he sent a message, "The same disciple, I want him back tomorrow."
Mm-hmm.
And Yajnavalkya refused to do that.
Oh.
So his teacher says that we are going to be in kind of a, you know, financial
problem
because the king will be, Yajnavalkya says, "I do not care. I will walk out even from this ashram," and he established his own school.
Oh.
And he was running that school, and if at all, his need for money was for the school rather than for himself. Because he has a big school.
Do you know where that story is found? I don't know that story.
I heard about it, you know.
Purana.
I have not read it, so I cannot exactly tell you the source. But
might be in the Purana. I'm not sure. I don't
think you're a huge school. He has lots of students.
Are there any more questions?
Just one quick.
Yeah.
That the same way semen, virya to be translated into semen is also very inappropriate.
Yes.
But your interpretation of prana was fantastic. It really is very appealing. And in Sanskrit, there is no singular for prana. You have got to use it in plural. You have got to prana. Yeah.
Right,
And that shows the variety of forms of energy.
Right. But as far as semen goes, I would prefer, I think it would be perfectly legitimate to translate it as seed, and then it works for both men and women.
Or life force.
Yeah. Well, no, it's got to go behind the life force. It's got to go behind that. Seed is the best translation for it. Seed is contributed by both genders. Anyway, are there any other questions, comments today? I have a couple of announcements. next Sunday, the open forum topic will be on anger. You remember we had a presentation on anger and controlling anger, and that will be the topic for all of us. So bring your ideas about either expressing or controlling anger. It'll be interesting. And two more announcements. Let's see, what were they? Oh, yes. On Thursday, the evening class will be replaced by reception for a nun from Hollywood. As you know, I think you've all heard this. Gayatri Prana from our Hollywood convent will be speaking and being received by us at 8 o'clock Thursday evening. I hope all of you will be able to turn out for that. And what else is there? I guess that's all. Oh, for those in the Christian Writings class, we have to move just for 1 month. We have to move it from the first week to the second week, second Saturday instead of the first Saturday.
In June.
Yes, the first in June. Yeah. And I guess we're ready to do our benediction.
Do we have guests?
Hmm?
Visiting guests?
No, we've already introduced Nina and Jillian. And I don't think the butlers are guests exactly.
Larry's here.
Oh, you know, I'm so used to seeing him at community. I see him every Sunday night, so I didn't recognize. I realize it. Sorry. Larry, what's your last name? Larry is here today. I'm just looking at that familiar face, so I didn't spark to that. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.